Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend, Bishop Marian Budde of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. and the National Cathedral. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus and practicing nonviolence and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin, as I always like to, with a little prayer. So I just invite you, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and relax, and let's recenter ourselves again. And I invite you to enter into the presence of the God of peace, who loves you infinitely, personally, and everyone everywhere too. And let's welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us, and take a moment to ask for whatever grace we need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and do God's will. Beloved God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, heal us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will. To do our part, to help end war, poverty, racism, greed, injustice, nuclear weapons, environmental destruction, and all violence, that we might be your holy peacemakers and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, amen. Friends, it's a great blessing to welcome my friend, Bishop Marian Budde of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. and the National Cathedral. She is the first woman elected to this position and has become a global, well-known advocate and organizer in support of justice, racial equality, gun violence prevention, immigration reform, the full inclusion of LGBT persons, and the care of creation. Prior to her election, Marian served for 18 years as rector of St. John's Episcopal Church in Minneapolis. She earned a BA in history at the University of Rochester and a master in divinity and a doctor of ministry from Virginia Theological Seminary. She's the author of three books, most recently the bestseller, How We Learn to Be Brave, Decisive Moments in Life and Faith. Bishop Marian Budde, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be with you, John.
Thank you. Really, I'm going to call you Marian.
Please, so, drop Bishop, please. Yes.
Your Eminence. I want to tell everybody, first of all, full disclosure, that I want to begin by really thanking Marian, because she's really helped me out on a bad day. Once, about 10 years ago, some friends and I were arrested at the Supreme Court protesting the U.S. death penalty. And it was this moving action, very prayerful. And wow, did they go after us. And we spent two really awful days in jail. And nobody in the group, there are only 20 of us, ever slept. And I was with our mutual friend, Doug, in this tiny cell. And I was in the top metal plank, 3 feet from this massive fluorescent light, which was in my face all night. And the walls of the cell were covered with cockroaches. I kid you not. And about 2 a.m, I went into a full-on panic attack and PTSD from previous times in prison and in El Salvador. And Doug and I had been arguing in jail, earlier in the day, about who's better, Bruce Springsteen or the Beatles. And so I made Doug get up, and I said, we have to fight this out just to distract my mind. We were eventually released on a Friday afternoon, and Doug said, we're going to see Marian. It's an emergency. So we went to Bishop Marian's house, and she took us in from jail and made us a big dinner and cared for us, and I'll never forget it. And for the record, she practices the hospitality, kindness, and mercy that she's called the whole world to, even towards a troublemaker and prisoner like me. So thanks, Marian. That's my official thank you after all these years.
It was such an honor to meet you in that way and that group. And I always tell our mutual friend Doug that he always has a place to stay after he's been arrested in Washington, and that goes for you and
okay,
all of your friends.
I need to get arrested then again very soon. That's how I'll get dinner with you. I want to say, too, on behalf of the thousands who are listening, just a sincere, heartfelt thank you for your extraordinary global leadership and speaking out since that famous day at the cathedral. But I thought we could start by just talking in general, from your perspective, mm-hmm. about the country and the world under the Trump administration, its wars, its corruption, the growing fascism. It's more than racism. It's full-on white supremacy, authoritarianism, the end of democracy, growing Christian nationalism. And how you think Christians in the U.S. might be called to respond to this moment we're enduring.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you starting off with a soft question there, John. That
You're
makes
welcome.
Me feel like
yes.
we're in for an easy conversation. Well, let me begin first of all by thanking you, and second by reminding us all of the obvious that Christians, we are well represented in every category of humanity that is part of this country, and that goes, you know, socioeconomic class, race, geography, political persuasion, life experience. And so when we, you know, when we think about what is the Christian response, a lot of it depends on who we are, where we find ourselves, what our particular vulnerabilities, contradictions, life experiences surface for us. So I would never say to anyone, here's what you need to do. However, there are core practices that have to ground us all if we're going to say, going to claim the, you know, the mantle or the identity as a Jesus follower. And that is to be, to adhere as close as we can to his teachings, to cultivate a living relationship with the universal Christ, to recognize our own inabilities to live up to the aspirational life to which he calls us, which gives us needed humility. And then from time to time, we will be summoned in ways large or small to serve or to speak up, to do something hard, to follow him in a particular way. And you mentioned the challenges that we're facing and the systematic dismantling of the apparatus of the federal government, sort of the parts that are meant to protect us, the distortions of the Christian witness that are being promulgated from the highest levels of power and corporate greed. You know, there's a lot that could just stop us in our tracks. And I would say, do the next thing. Do the next faithful thing that you sense God might be asking of you. And if you don't hear anything, look at somebody you admire and imitate that person or spend time in that person's presence until you have a bit of a window into what might be yours to do as one of the followers of Jesus.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Marianne. Well, you attracted global attention when you led the prayer service after President Trump's second inauguration at the National Cathedral and called him and the country very gently to show mercy to immigrants and others, to all those mm-hmm. who were afraid. And he quickly denounced you, and many others did too. I wonder, I know you've told this story probably a million times, but you know, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us the story of that experience for you, what you hoped he might do, and also maybe share with us some of the aftermath for you of your mm-hmm. statement.
Yeah. Well, thanks for asking it. Yeah, a lot of time has gone by. And yet I would say that I knew for months that I would be preaching at an interfaith prayer service for the nation the day after the inauguration. That had been announced before we knew the outcome of the election. And then after the outcome of the election, I knew that I would be offering that reflection to members of the Trump administration and the president himself, if he decided to come, which we didn't know if he would. And I would say that I felt two things. One was that I had to speak the truth about the dangers of praying for unity as a country when we were, as a people, and certainly those who were now elected in power, had no intention of working toward that unity. And it became very clear that division and polarization were going to continue at a fearsome rate. So I wanted to name that without, you know, being in your face, but just as clear as I could be. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing, as you know, is I knew there were many people who were terrified and who wondered if there was a place for them in this newly configured alignment of political power and future actions. And I simply wanted people to know that I saw them and that I wanted to take the opportunity to remind the most powerful person in the country that he could afford to be generous and that we all could afford to be generous with mercy because we all stand in equal need of it at one time or another. Well, that was what led up to it. Shall I continue?
Or yeah, please. No, I'm just enraptured listening to you. And what happened that day and then in the months afterwards?
Yeah, well, you know, it was pretty clear that the president wasn't pleased.
Many
of his supporters thought I was, you know, wildly inappropriate. They didn't like what I said. You know, he thought the service was boring, which I've heard before from all kinds of people. So that criticism is nothing new. What can I say about that? For maybe 48 to 72 hours, it was very intense. But then the tide shifted and we were on the receiving end. When I say we, the cathedral, my diocese, we were all on the receiving end of such enormous gratitude.
Wow.
And I can't tell you how many letters I received that began with some version of thank you. I'm not a Christian myself, but I so appreciate. I have a son who came out X number of years ago, and I'm so worried about him. You know, on and on and on. And for them and for all of us, I am grateful to have had the opportunity.
Well, thank you, Marianne. And, you know, I can't remember any public figure calling for mercy. I'm sure, besides Pope Francis, but certainly in the United States. So it's just a word that's not in the U.S. lexicon. So thank you for doing it. Then, Marianne, a year later, you returned to your hometown in Minneapolis. I guess you were invited, and you spoke out against the ICE raids and the killings of, God bless them, Renee and Alex and others. So tell us what it was like to be in Minneapolis during those demonstrations, I guess in January, and then marching and speaking out against ICE and Trump's mass deportation campaigns.
Well, you're in California. I'm in Washington, D.C., and the ICE raids had begun almost immediately with the new administration, and they were escalating in intensity and violence from city to city, you know. And so we were watching this unfold, and then when the new budget was passed and ICE received this enormous influx of money, there was nothing that kept the administration from inflicting such damage to the city of Minneapolis and the state of Minnesota. And I don't know what it was like for you in the lead up to the big events, but I was receiving emails and texts, phone calls from friends and former colleagues, family members saying, no matter what you're hearing or seeing about what's happening here, we can't begin to describe it to how terrifying it is and what we're watching happen. And then all of the examples, people being torn out of their cars, windows being smashed into houses, childcare centers being places where parents were being arrested or children were being used as bait, and all the horrors. And so then the clergy and political leaders of Minnesota, you saw them respond. The people responded with such courage. And at some point, there were invitations for people to come from around the country to stand in solidarity. They didn't have to ask me twice. And so I was there. And I was one of many, hundreds and hundreds of people mm-hmm. who took part in prayer services, mm-hmm. vigils. We walked in 20 degree below. Weather. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was really cold. And there was this this sense of resolve and horror and exhaustion and fear and courage, defiance. I've never been part of anything like it.
Wow. I was following you there, and I'm grateful that you went on all our behalfs. And one of the things you said in your speech was love of neighbor is not optional. Now, that is so basic and simple. And yet, I don't know anyone in the United States saying, let's love one another and love our neighbors. And yet, it's the hallmark of the gospel. I mean, it's like a bottom line. And so I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about that basic statement you made, because, as I said, I don't hear many church people talking about loving one another or neighbors. I mean, in fact, we're being instructed who not to love, whether it be people in our neighborhood or people around the world. And that's the opposite of Jesus. So talk about love of neighbors, not an optional.
Right. Well, you know, you read your scriptures and you stay close to Jesus and the other biblical masters, and it's pretty clear. In fact, he doesn't stop at neighbor.
Right.
We're to love our enemies. And so the mandate, the biblical mandate, gospel mandate, points us in the direction of love always. And I would argue with you, John. I think love of neighbor is more pervasive than perhaps this administration realized.
Oh, that's great to hear. I hope you're right.
I think right now it's been underground. It's been overwhelmed by an equally powerful or seemingly equally powerful mean-spiritedness of which we are all capable. Right? We are human. We have all of that in us.
Yeah.
What was it that Solzhenitsyn said, that the line between good and evil flows through the human heart? So we all have to tend to our hearts and our capacity to love. But I'm seeing it, mm-hmm. and we saw it, and we still see it in places like Minnesota, here in Washington. Now, the other side is also true. We're seeing large-scale suffering. And so I think it's all the more important for us to persevere.
So in another recent interview, you said, you talked about the division and the need to speak to people across the divide. So I want to ask you about mm-hmm. that. Maybe I'll give you the quote that I read that you said. So here's what Marianne said: we are awash in a culture of contempt that is encouraging us to treat one another, particularly those with whom we might disagree, in the most dehumanizing and degrading ways. We're all being socialized to do that. It's infecting everything, whether we realize it or not. We don't know how to have honest and respectful conversations across differences with a baseline of dignity. So give us some tips about how do we do that. I think everyone in the country is going through that with a relative or a friend who has just moved in a completely different direction than them.
Well, I tell you, John, it was before the election, maybe it was after the election and before the inauguration. I came across a podcast and then a lecture highlighting the current work of Tim Shriver, head of the Special Olympics,
yes,
member of the Kennedy clan.
My friend, yeah.
And he and a group of others several years ago made the bold decision to focus on the rise of contempt in our country as one of the most, the most significant issues that we need to address. That if we don't address that, we can't solve anything. And they were the ones who introduced me to this idea of the culture of contempt and the way contempt has infected so much of our public and increasingly our private speech. And they've crafted something called a dignity index, an 8-point scale that helps us measure speech according to levels of dignity or contempt. And I have become a student of the Dignity Index. And I've committed myself to speak to the highest degree I'm capable of. I'm not always successful with language of dignity. No matter how vehemently I disagree, no matter how much contempt is coming my way, I strive to respond in language of dignity, which is simply acknowledging the inherent dignity of every human being. Doesn't mean respect. Respect is earned, but dignity is something we are given by God.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Marianne. Tim's going to be on this podcast in a couple of weeks.
Well,
so I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. And I'll ask him more about that.
All about that.
Okay. Well, then let me ask you this, because remember, I'm a child of Daniel and Philip Berrigan. And
I know you are.
They raised me to speak out bold and loud and brash. And in the prophetic tradition. Now, I'm just talking about speaking truth. Well, after 45 years and being a grouchy old curmudgeonly priest now, you know, I had to practice what Tim and you are talking about there. And this is what you did at the National Cathedral, and you've been doing it so well. How do we fulfill, what do I call it, the prophetic role of the church or the call of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount to carry on the message of the prophets to speak truth to power and for an end to all these wars and racism and nukes and hatred and gun violence and destruction of creation, but to do it nonviolently and I suppose nonviolently and fearlessly and with a lot of love. But I think people are either scared to do it or then we get so angry, you know, we don't do it with the kind of kindness that you're talking about. But either way, it's going to be hard. And Jesus, paid for speaking out.
Well, first of all, let me say, it's not that harsh language, even contemptuous language, doesn't have some place. Do you know what I mean? Like, but to strive to speak with dignity gives us more options, and to lean into it protects us from gratuitous contempt and meeting hatred with hatred. And all of the nonviolent masters remind us how futile that is. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing that is to remember is that we are to hold our positions, our points of view, but to speak them in such a way that they might actually be received and heard. And it's a challenge, and it is costly. I was asked if I would apologize to the president because I had offended him. It's not my intention to offend anyone, but I also wasn't going to apologize. Right? I felt like I was speaking truth and gospel truth. And so if it offended him, I regret that. And it was still the truth I felt called to speak. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And
thank you.
And I feel like, I mean, and I think Pope Leo, of course, has been doing that very clearly in response to the Iran war. Non-defensively, clearly, powerfully.
And as we're recording this, we're witnessing President Trump attack Pope Leo viciously, pretty regularly now, for his comments against the U.S. bombing and killing in Iran and so many other things, including the loss of democracy here in the U.S. And then we've seen the vice president tell the Pope he shouldn't be talking theology, and he's got this theology is all wrong. And then we had the president send out, you know, pictures of himself as Jesus. So we're moving into just real blasphemy and heresy, and all of this is to be expected. You've been asked a lot to comment on this in the media, and and you are doing it in a way that's trying to be maintain your dignity and the dignity of people, but you're trying to speak the truth. Tell us about some of your responses to what's happening.
Well, first of all, it's nothing new. The president has assumed, misappropriately assumed, religious symbolism and the mantle of Christianity to justify actions that have very little to do with what Jesus stands for. So that's just a given. And the extreme of that in this war is worrisome. It's also not just that one meme. It's across the entire, across the entire endeavor. Like, this is a holy war. Jesus is on our side. Jesus is as violent as possible. I mean, it's just terrible. So to have the popes be very clear about that from his international perspective is just so very powerful. The president doesn't like to be criticized by anybody, right? And the way he's treating the Pope is how he treats everybody who dares to cross his path in an unpleasant way for him. So it's to be expected. It's offensive. But I don't think we should be distracted by it. The real issue is the war and the loss of life and the displacement of millions and the lack of interest in modulating tactics to accomplish necessary goals on the global theater, on the global.
Thank you for saying all of that. And to keep the focus on our job is to speaking out, continue to speak out against the U.S. war in Iran and all the wars and for the abolition of nuclear weapons and executions and racism and really to rebuild the country and the world and for justice for the poor. On that note, as you know, much of my life has been trying to reclaim the nonviolence of Jesus and teach this basic truth, Marianne, that Jesus was nonviolent like Gandhi and Dr. King and Dorothy Day. And so I wondered if you might address that briefly in any which way you want. What if you had a story or a verse or anything about the nonviolent Jesus that might encourage our listeners and something that motivates you and might motivate us?
I'm so thankful that you asked this question. For me, the images of Jesus, as you mentioned, first of all, his absolute compassion, preference in the sense of keeping his focus on the most vulnerable of his day, and assuring that people knew how God cared, genuinely cared for all human beings. So that just the love of Jesus. And then when he was confronted with resistance, when he moved into Jerusalem deliberately to take his message to the seats of religious and political power and met with resistance there, eventual crucifixion, he never wavered from nonviolence, not once. And I feel that I'm not capable of that on my own, but the grace of God, the love of God revealed in Jesus is what we're called to.
It's wonderful. We have a nonviolent Savior, a nonviolent Messiah, and I think because of his perfect total nonviolence, he literally saves us from ourselves, our violence, mm-hmm. and shows us a way out of our insanity. What sustains you these days as being our leader? You're our leader, Marianne, in this public work and the role you've been given as the bishop out of Washington, D.C. in the National Cathedral, but not only for the country, I think for people around the world. How are you? What's your practice these days to keep you going?
There are a lot of us, John, who are toiling in this vineyard. I don't feel especially alone in this work. I have, in many ways, a privileged life, plenty to eat, safe home to live in, family and friends, meaningful work. So I am among those to whom much has been given. And so I try to offer what I can. In terms of spiritual practice, I have to confess to you that God is much more faithful to me than I am to practices that keep me in a contemplative way close to God. And God shows up for me, the Spirit of God shows up for me in ways that takes my breath away. And the parable that I lean on, two of them actually, and one is the miracle of the loaves, mm-hmm. and the fish, and how, for me, what that says is the invitation to me, to all of us, is to offer what we have and not worry when we see the gap between our offering and what's needed, but to offer and leave the work of God to God.
That's beautiful. Thank you. What was your mm-hmm. other parable?
Well, it's actually not so much a parable, but it's when Jesus is in Bethany, mm-hmm. and he is praying, and he says, now my soul is troubled. And what should I say? Father, spare me from this hour. No, it is for this reason that I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. Wow. And I feel like we're all in some way here now. And we would rather be somewhere else. I would rather be in a different context. I would rather my children and grandchildren be dealing with different realities than the ones that they're facing. But we're here now, and it's for this hour that we're here. And so I feel I can pray in a very small way that Jesus prayer and ask God to be glorified.
That's so helpful. Well, we're really at the end of our time, and so for my last question, let me ask, is there anything you'd like to say, any word of encouragement to all our thousands of listeners to keep going in this time? Maybe you've just said it, but anything last message?
I don't think any of us can know the significance of our efforts to be instruments of peace. And so to be of good courage, and as Paul says, hold fast all that is good, and trust that there is more at work in the world than the evil we are witnessing. And it's not all up to us, but we're needed. And that's amazing.
That's beautiful. And so we'll trust God together and keep going forward and know that it's in God's hands. Thank you so much, Bishop Marion Budde, for speaking with me today. And thank you, friends, for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudescenter.org. And there you can sign up to receive our free e-blast with news about upcoming podcasts and Zooms. And please tell your friends and coworkers about this podcast. And I'm going to give a shameless plug for my book, new book, Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. And get Marianne's new book, How We Learn to Be Brave. And if you're on Substack, you can look me up at Father John Deere. So may the God of peace bless you all. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. See you next time.